Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for the 25th of September 2013. Thanks for joining us for the last weekly podcast of the month. September has flown past and I'm sure the rest of the year is going to be exactly the same. And we are working hard on bringing you the new AV Forums very soon. More on that in the next few weeks. But let's crack on with this week's podcast. And joining me, our news editor, Mark Hodgkinson.
Prepare to be humiliated on cable television.
Games editor, Mark Botwright.
Nobody makes me bleed my own blood. Nobody.
Audio reviewer, Ed Selly.
No, but I do it anyway because it's sterile and I like the taste.
And rock fan, Steve Withers.
A dread pirate Steve being no man's debt.
So let's go straight to hardware news. And strange little audio show, Ed, Whittlebury Hall. It's been going for 4 years now.
I think 4 years is right, yes.
So it's one of these that really does bring in the enthusiast crowd.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
I was going to say in inverted commas. Yeah. Tell us all about it.
It's a bit of a strange fish. There's no getting around that. Although it worked under the slightly ambitious title of the National Audio Show, it has actually fallen into quite a comfortable niche where it allows for more high-end distributors and more niche distributors than would perhaps go to Bristol, because obviously Bristol is still tied into a national chain of dealers who don't stock every single product. And even though, you know, Bristol does allow for a wider a scope than that, there's still some limitations imposed. So Whittlebury has sort of become, if you like, a sort of miniature sort of high-end and obscurity fest. Although it still has one thing, which is probably the only time I've ever seen it in the UK, and it's a blindingly good idea, which is a headphone zone where all the people trying to sell headphones are placed into a single large room. And because they're operating exclusively on headphone amplifiers, you can actually listen to a great many of the designs that are out on the market and that matter. And because everyone's just doing headphones, there's no background noise to sort of drown out. And it works splendidly well. Otherwise, it was the sort of standard pattern of things that you can't really afford. Manufacturers that you don't see anywhere else in the UK, Wavac. There were some Wavac valve amplifiers from Japan. I believe that they brought some fairly low-end model these times, so about £60,000-£75,000. Otherwise, it was mainly stuff that you'd have to be reasonably well off to afford. But it was actually very well attended by its own standards. Numbers were up on last year, and it's got an excellent bar. I'm sure that doesn't necessarily matter, but at the very least, it's got plenty of room for people who are all hi-fied out to have a sit down and chew the fat. The fat in this case coming from the fact that every year they do a proper bona fide hog roast as well, which was nice. So, yes, it proved diverting to pass a day. In terms of groundbreaking new product, I'm afraid there probably wasn't any, but it was a perfectly pleasant way to spend a weekend.
Sounds like the only thing missing was the bowl with the keys in, but then again, it's hi-fi.
Well, it would have been exclusively male. I'm a very open-minded person, but even so, it's interesting to compare to IFA with wall-to-wall promo girls. There were, I think there was a promo girl at the show, and she had that sort of look of shock and horror of someone that knows that they're really, really quite a long way out of their depth.
Staying with high-end hi-fi, Macintosh, you reviewed one of their products a little earlier in the year, Ed. They've just announced the ME6700, and all I know is it's $7,000. It's not seven channels, it's only two channels, and it's got those ugly 70s VU meters on them.
How dare you? I'm sorry, VU meters at the moment are proving surprisingly popular as a style choice, and Macintosh stuff has always looked, it's unfair to say it looks retro. It's always looked like that. So at some stage, it mustn't have been retro. It must have just been how they were doing it. The looks, yes, they do divide opinion. I will say that anyone fortunate enough to be in a position to buy one, it's likely to be staggeringly good and very possibly the last amplifier that they ever need to buy. Macintosh make great stock of being able to service, maintain, and keep going pretty much every single component they've ever made. And that's easy to do with stereo amplifiers, but nonetheless, we could do with more audio companies being able to do that with more of their products, because you can buy amplifiers that cost as much as that Macintosh, where I'm afraid that emphatically won't be the case.
I'm sure it said in the original press release, Mark, you can maybe help me out with this. I thought it was the first receiver in 20 years, but it doesn't have a tuner in it.
Yeah, there's a module you can buy. So this is the kind of spurious headline grabbing, we want a receiver in the title thing. But you can buy an optional FM-AM tuner for, I think it's £800. So that's how they lay claim to the receiver title. Of course, it's a bit pushing the truth a bit.
And it's only £800.
Just say £800, I think. Yours for £800.
On top of the £7,000 you've already paid.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at least you don't have to buy it if you don't need it.
Which you probably won't.
Yes.
Well, AM FM in the UK is a bit of a tough sell, but it carries a bit more. I dare say, that, joking aside, some of our friends across the channel will be quite happy to spend what will be about €1,000 adjusted for exchange rates, and in the US it does extremely well as well. Although that said, don't get into the habit of thinking that Macintosh are actually just old fashioned, because they do some fairly impressive AV processors which are full recognizably bang up to date spec, and they're very, very good at the Sirius XM format, which is used in the States. They make some extremely good XM radio receivers as well. Not that I know if they're any good, because obviously they can't come to the UK because they won't do anything when they do, but you know, it's a minor downside.
So that looks like all the hardware news that we have for this week. Bit strange, no 4K news, Mark?
This week, I think we've not reported on it yet because we're so busy on the back end of the new site. But Netflix have been talking 4K again this week. Interview with a Scandinavian journalist, just saying that they were looking for a minimum of 15 megabits per second download, which sounds a bit, I don't know, it doesn't sound enough to me, even with HEVC. But that's about all the 4K I can think of in the last few days.
Okay, I just didn't want to end the hardware news
without mentioning 4K. No, 4K. Fair enough.
That would be wrong. I don't know about you. I mean, I've had... it would appear that, just in case we didn't think there were enough soundbars on the market, there's two more being launched from Harman Kardon. There's more rumblings from Canton, Quadral, two German.
They're all doing it. I mean, literally losing count.
I'll be able to do, depending on how the new back end of the site stands up to it. Some of the most extensive group testery that you can possibly imagine. I could do one a month and not get through the sheer variety of them coming out. So if we thought there were quite a lot of soundbars already, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah.
So that's it for hardware. Moving on to games next. So moving on to games, Mark, some sad news about the former Nintendo president.
Yes, Hiroshi Yamauchi's died at 85. It's after the sad news about Ray Dolby last week. It seems almost like an end of an era. It was his career had kind of pretty much spanned all of Nintendo's success, from a kind of family business making playing cards for traditional Japanese games through children's games and board games and even sports equipment and various other little avenues. And it's very much a story about the rise of Nintendo, and it's very interesting to note that his departure seemed to have coincided with the upturn with the Nintendo Wii, but by the same token, almost that aversion to risk-taking some saw in him would perhaps have also nullified them going ahead with the Wii U. It was very much an executive figure, the type that these days, it's strange, we tend to kind of distrust anyone who comes from the executive sphere, like, you know, your Bulma figures and those kind of guys. But he didn't play video games. He didn't have any great interest in them. He very much just followed the ethos of, what works, keeping a business adaptable, And so therefore that's what kind of allowed him to pretty much innovate at every sphere. He hired the people that he felt were right for the positions. And just notably, when he took over the company, his grandparents fell ill, he fired it. I think it was his cousin and various other high-ranking executives, and basically a clean sweep. And from there, it just seems like he all the high points of Nintendo coincided with these very kind of brave decisions to offset the video games crash of 83 and Atari going to the wall. And so, you know, a world without him would almost be a world without the video games that we know them today.
So he appointed Miyamoto, did he? Is that right?
Yes. He pretty much everything. I mean, you go through from board games through arcade games and Donkey Kong, you know, through the Game & Watch and the rise of the portable games console through the Nintendo. I mean, when you look at when the NES actually hit, it was around the time of the crash, and basically he had to kind of almost make it very lucrative for businesses to keep selling video games, because there was a very real chance. It seems weird to think of it these days, but there was a very real chance that lots of shops would have just stopped selling video games. They would have just said, look, this isn't going to be profitable anymore. I mean, it was kind of in the same way that various app stores have become kind of choked with, you know, shovelware and various other kind of bits of absolute tat. That's basically what the video game market was at the time. And so, you know, to think that out of all that, at a time when you had kind of a dozen different consoles all vying for supremacy, and ultimately it's all of the software was of highly questionable quality, the fact that he decided that one affordable console with good quality games, that if everyone was going to be buying 5 or 6 games, then that was worth it to kind of cut certain margins and be very ruthless in a kind of very old school autocratic Japanese executive style. You know, it very much took that influence from Japan to be able to create the modern video game industry.
But do you think that actually helped in many ways? Because coming from outside of the bubble and with a more sort of balanced business take on you know, what must have seemed like a cataclysm to people more closely involved in software development, it's a case of looking at, you know, looking at market trends and having the confidence to stick it out and make decisions on a level beyond that of simple software and hardware and actually knowing more about it. And in many ways, we were just, you know, we're saying executive guys like Ballmer aren't that popular. I think actually in many ways he might even be different again if you know, as you say, he cut his teeth long before Nintendo was you know, well, long before there were a games console industry to be involved in. And it sort of, if you like, it furthered the way that the company operated, because he wasn't quite so tightly sort of wrapped in the software and the hardware bit of it.
Yeah, I think he was the perfect man for the right time. I think there are particular kind of cycles where you need different types of executives. I think it's funny that these days, you know, people tend to distrust anyone who is more of a kind of traditional suit. Well, Yamauchi was exactly that. He looked every inch the executive, the kind of man who would look at spreadsheets and numbers as opposed to what he actually felt, because he had no interest really in the sphere. But it's also, he was the right man for the right time. But since the kind of demographic has moved on, I think it was right that he eventually did retire, because when you look at where they got a lot of success, the ball rolling with, you know, Disney themes on playing cards and video gaming was very much seen as a child's medium, that now that we've kind of gone beyond that, in a strange way, Nintendo has almost molded itself outward. It's almost evolved past his ethos of something universal, and now almost every Nintendo console is defined by its control medium. So I mean, the GameCube had a weird controller that just no third parties really wanted to try and map their games to. Then you look at the Wii, the same thing. The N64 was pretty much the same with its kind of weird three-pronged approach, whereas the systems that have actually stuck around have been the ones that have stuck with fairly much generic pads and have just tried to, you know, just mold it slightly, just try to refine the design rather than going for anything that's absolutely revolutionary. You know, he wasn't necessarily a risk taker. I mean, famously, the Virtual Boy was one of the kind of big risks that he took, and that absolutely blew up. And you can see that in fact, where Nintendo really made huge masses of money under his watch was the Game Boy and taking that handheld medium along. I mean, just keep doing basically the same console, different iterations, just improve it enough each time, and you don't have to have the most powerful console.
Well, they might be lucky to be in that position soon, really. I mean, I think handheld's the best opportunity. I don't think they'll be following up with another home console after the Wii U's done. I can't see much life in that.
No, but there again, I mean, looking at the Japanese gaming sphere, I mean, the Tokyo Game Show's just ended, and people have been saying just how kind of slightly miserable and depressing it is, because none of the big, or a lot of the big Japanese publishers haven't even bothered showcasing anything new. Some of them didn't even bother showing up. You know, really, in Japan, the home console market is shrinking significantly year on year. And it's, in fact, handhelds are the things that, you know, Japanese gamers love more than anything. Yeah. That's their primary choice.
Right, so moving on from handhelds, I guess the other big story, Mark, is GTA 5. It's made $1 billion in 3 days. My Twitter feed's been full of it for the last, God knows how long, 4 days, 5 days. So where are we at the minute, and has it lived up to the hype?
Yes, very much so. It's getting kind of sweeping tens across the board, most places nines and tens. You know, anyone who dares to give it less than that is incurring serious wrath. And I mean, the benchmark was laid down last year. Activision Call of Duty Black Ops 2 made $500 million in 24 hours, and that seemed a kind of excessive amount. And okay, we're coming at the end of a console life cycle where there are more machines in houses than there's ever likely to be. Again, you know, this is pretty much the peak before people tail off into another generation. But Grand Theft Auto 5 sold $800 million worth in 24 hours. And bear in mind that's not even including Japan.
That just blows out of the water any kind of movie box office, isn't it? It's just a staggering amount of money in one day.
Record set for any media. Anything, you know, pick it, Harry Potter, Star Wars, it's blown absolutely everything out of the water.
That's 2.5 times more than GTA 4, apparently. I'm just, as I'm reading on the internet right now.
How much did they spend developing this game?
I was about to ask.
200 million, wasn't it?
It was about, I've heard anywhere between 150 million and 170 million. But either way, if in 3 days you've made at least 5 times your money back, even if you're taking an even higher estimate, it's not bad business.
Does it tail off significantly after the opening sort of few days?
I think the hype definitely pushes everyone towards getting it. If you're going to buy it, you tend to buy it on launch day, or at least in launch week. There are copious amounts of copies out there. But by the same token, you will get a reasonable amount of people coming back in with, you know, game stores will be running promotions, you know, another chart game, trade it in, that kind of thing. I've no doubt there'll be
Christmas market as well, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, Christmas. That's got to be huge, you know. I mean, they're already pushing the big ads on TV are already pushing on PlayStation 3. Well, it's on the Xbox 360 as well, but you know, everyone's trying to get their name associated with it.
Yes.
The funniest bit of news story I saw all week, other than the crane at the local McDonald's going through the roof, it actually fell over onto the McDonald's. That's quite funny. Was that my hometown is actually mentioned. It's a part of the GTA 5.
You were born in Los Santos?
No, but there's a section of it, and it's called a druggy section of the city. It is actually called Hoyk, which is where I come from. And obviously the developers are based, or some of the development team are based in Scotland, and they keep trying to get Scottish things in there. There was a saltire, which, what was the name of it again?
Bossack,
yeah.
Balzac isn't the French author.
But anyway, the no, Steve, no. Don't go there. Obviously,
this is a man.
Too highbrow for this podcast?
I think so.
So you've misconstrued every insult to you thus far, Steve.
Yeah.
Look it up on the Urban Dictionary.
I was extremely well read.
But anyway, you can't spell on this toilet wall. You go round with your little marker pen, crossing it out.
Yeah, so anyway, my hometown is part of the game, and the local councillors went off their nuts. They were not happy.
You said there was a quote, there was a report, wasn't there? I can't remember exactly word for word, but one of the guys said, "I've never even seen a gun."
No one can ever heard of your hometown.
Yeah, well, I mean,
told me about it.
My hometown is basically, you know, the biggest problem the police have got are kids on mopeds. You know, that is the height of crime. It's just a sleepy little Scottish town.
But I'm glad you pronounced it, because I was going to say Howick.
Well, you see, that's how everybody pronounces it, but it's actually Hoik. Like, I'm going to hoik my breeks up.
Presumably it needs to be a name that's easy to pronounce when you're on heroin, so...
Yeah, it's hilarious. I've never seen a gun. Why are they picking on us? They don't get the thing that if you get publicity from this. It was like there was a town near my hometown called Lauder, and they had a float thing, like a carnival thing. And one of the floats, all the guys on it had dressed up as Jimmy Savile. But it got them national news, and everybody that had never heard of Lauder had now heard of the place, you know what I mean? So there's no such thing as bad publicity.
I have to say, I can relate to the Trevor bloke. You know, it's good to see a man, a protagonist in a video game, with the basic sort of physique and desperation that, you know, I as a normal, albeit slightly fatter person, can get behind. I respect that.
I see Hoik's there because Rockstar, are they a Scottish-based company?
Based in Edinburgh.
Yeah, based in Edinburgh. And my hometown's like 30 miles south of Edinburgh, so that's why they chose it.
Is it pronounced Hoik in the game, though?
Steve, I don't play video games, I don't know.
It's probably never said. It'll just be on the map.
Well, I can tell you what a friend of mine texted me after he got GTA 5. And I'm not making this up. Forget all the hype and bullshit you may have read about it, the ludicrous amount of praise and the thorough abuse of the word masterpiece. This is no common or garden masterpiece. It's the most overwhelmingly jaw-dropping magnum opus produced by humanity ever. If it really did cost the same amount of money as Avatar, the film, not the game, then it has to rank as history's greatest bargain. It's pointless reading off superlatives. None of them are adequate.
Quite liked it then.
That's never 160 characters.
No, that was a text, not a tweet.
I can remember when texts used to have to be limited to that as well, so showing my age.
Yes, he quite liked it. He took a whole week off work just to play it.
I was going to buy it, then I bought two records instead, because I'm with the kids.
So, moving on to tech news, iOS 7. Has everybody downloaded it?
I've got it on my iPad.
Yeah. Well, I've got to say, my battery now lasts half of what it used to last, and I'm not impressed. I think the design is just trying too hard. It's too white. It's too flat.
I turned off after about 4 seconds. I turned the animated wallpapers off. I've just gone for a fixed colour one. And that has improved matters. It still has a vaguely Fisher Price feel to it, but I'm sure that'll pass. I don't know. It hasn't changed my life tremendously in either way. And I can't speak for my phone battery life because I haven't updated that yet because it's very old and I don't think that's going to do any good. But battery life on the iPad appears very much the same. So I colour me underwhelmed, if you will. I'm sure that actually it will give opportunities for some companies to come out with some very, very nice new icons. I think at the moment it looks worse than it will because we've still got a load of the rendered icons from companies that haven't updated yet. But as and when they get their act in gear, I think it could end up looking tidier, especially once there's more wallpaper options and you can find something which doesn't make your eyes bleed.
Aren't people over expecting these days from an operating system release? I mean,
the only thing that's a bit different about this is, as I understand it, this is the first Jony Ive's based one. So there was an expectation that it was going to be different, and as I understand it, it is a clean sheet. It's not
right.
It represents a new sort of direction. But yes, I think people do get. But to be honest, people get massively overexcited about anything new to do with Apple full stop, in my old and grumpy opinion. Yeah. But equally, don't get me wrong, the one sort of feature that has arrived, which I've used, you know, repeatedly and I like, mainly because I don't play Temple Run, is if you now swipe up from the bottom of the screen, you get a quick access control panel. And it's much easier to switch Bluetooth on and off and do all sorts of things where previously it was buried away.
Androids had for a while.
Oh, yeah, almost certainly. But whereas it was a faff with the older versions, it's less of a faff now. Yeah. I think that's a useful step forward. And as I say, once the color palette sorts itself out, the icons sort themselves out, I'm sure it will be fine. But, am I tremendously excited about it? No. That's about as much as I can say.
I quite like the parallax effect behind the icons. Another OS, whatever. I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, it's just another OS, big deal. I don't quite know why it's getting so much press coverage.
It's been the biggest software update in terms of numbers of people who have downloaded it in Apple history. And they've also
that's because they've got an installed user base that's larger than they've ever had before. There,
yeah, and they've also shifted 9 million units in 3 days, which is up on the iPhone 5, which shifted 4.5 million.
How does that compare, though? To, I mean, the thing that always amazes me is, you get a new iPhone or something gets announced, so it makes BBC 9 o'clock news. I never see them reporting on the new phone from Samsung or the new phone from Sony. I think you kind of feel like the BBC or the media in general are complicit in this.
Well, they have to reach those kind of sales figures before it makes national news, don't they? There has to be one model of the Sony or the Samsung.
Way more mobile phones than Apple.
Yeah, the S4, I guess, is comparable in numbers, but nothing else really is.
Three times as many, I think. I mean, their numbers are much, much bigger than Apple.
No, I mean, one single phone. I mean, Apple have had one phone until now. But yeah, I think that's the point.
So they're not saying which is the most popular. But all they're saying is the 5S and the 5C units in 3 days is 9 million.
I read that the 5C was something like a tenth of the orders of the 5S over the weekend somewhere.
I can't see the point in buying a 5C when you can get 5S for like another 100.
Oh, but it's got a nice pink plastic back on it, Steve.
Yeah, they look really tacky and cheap.
Joking aside, I haven't seen one.
They're not.
I like the blue one. It's quite a nice blue. In preference, I'd rather have a blue one than a gold 5S, which is just horrible.
I think iOS 7 will looks nicer with the 5S.
I don't, because you can colour match the wallpaper to the shell of your 5C. Oh, yeah. It looks rather smart. Yeah.
And the new AV forums all suit the pink one, Steve.
Magenta, Phil. Magenta.
It's plum.
So just quickly staying on phones, BlackBerry in trouble. They've pulled out the consumer market altogether, axed 40% of their workforce, basically because the Z10? Is that the last phone that they released?
Yeah, well, it's just been flop after flop, really.
Yeah, seemingly that's been the biggest flop of all.
Yeah, because they were channeling that to be their big consumer phone with its touchy features and BBM upgrade. I mean, sorry, BlackBerry operating system upgrade and all the rest of it. But it's just fallen flat against the likes of the iPhone and the Galaxy. It's just the big trouble. Then
it's quite a good phone.
Yeah, I'm sure
it's a demonstration, if you like, that the hardware is less than half the story. I mean, I like it, but in buying one, I reduce the number of apps, widgets, and sort of supporting accessories that are available through either iOS or Android. I'd be reducing it by about 85% or something crazy.
I think that's
like
the problem anyone's got, isn't it, really? Trying to attack those established operating system platforms. But, big trouble there. And I think one of the things, relinquishing BBM, or for a while anyway, that was one of the great sort of selling points for the young, wouldn't it be? Every teenager had a BBM. A BlackBerry for BBM a couple of years ago. And then they relinquished that to iOS and they were releasing it for Android, although I just read that they've pulled the iOS version, but it seems like too little too late. They might as well monetize BBM in consumer phones while they can. So, yeah, they're in a disarray, I would say.
Yeah.
Not least because the corporate model, the number of companies that have switched over to systems where essentially you buy your own phone.
Yeah, I was going to mention BYOD. Yeah, I was going to mention BYOD. Another killer, another nail in the coffin of BlackBerry, really.
And the Department of, I can't remember which U.S. State Department it is, but they've been BlackBerry customers for donkey's years, and they aren't doing bring your own device, but they'd already decided to move straight over to Apple. So it strikes me as it's certainly I guess I can see the reasoning behind it, but I think that's too late and not gonna help them either. Yeah,
my wife has a BlackBerry, but not one of the Z10s, and she can't stand it. As a piece of technology, it feels it looks and feels outdated, and the Z10 obviously didn't do it for them. They staked far too much on that, and paid the price.
So that's BlackBerry going down the tubes. Well, they're actually just going back to business and government work, but pulling out a consumer market. While we're recording this Monday afternoon, Microsoft about to announce the Surface products. And I'm just quickly looking through TweetDeck at the moment. $499 US for Surface 2. Surface Pro 2 is $899.
Well, the Pro was doing okay, isn't it? So I think that'll probably hold its price. But $499, doesn't that seem a lot for the Surface 2?
Yeah, it does. Compared to competition.
Is that what? Is it you got the screen size?
I'm just quickly going through Twitter at the minute. They're keeping Surface RT for $350. That's the original. They're not updating it. Microsoft officially announces Surface Pro 2 tablet featuring new processor, improved battery and graphical performance.
Yada yada.
Looking for screen size. Nothing at the minute.
Right. So we're waiting for the small form. But yeah, that's small tablets they can't sell. If that's all they can give you is an upgraded processor.
Haven't they already got warehouses full of the original Surface they haven't flogged?
Yeah, that's the one they're now kicking out at $349.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's everything on that one. Obviously, Mark will update the news stories well before this podcast goes out, but as we're recording, that's what's happening. And finally, in tech, Tesco launched their own tablet, Mark,
£119. The Hubble, I believe it's called, H-U-B-L. Yep. Yeah, £119, mid-spec Android tablet, 7-inch screen, competitor for the Kindle and the Nexus 7, probably Nexus to, 7, to a lesser degree. And there's a billion of these devices, but of course Tesco have got a lot of marketing power just with people in the store. So they're going to do a massive in-store campaign and promotion, obviously it's because they've got a lot of people coming in. I dare say there'll be club card deals and all the rest of it, and it comes with, obviously, easy access to Tesco's online shopping. And Blinkbox, which is Tesco's answer to Netflix. So they'll also do a massive promotion on that at the same time.
Blinkbox is actually quite good. I had a little play with it. I watched Game of Thrones Season 3 on it, and I thought it had a decent selection of stuff at quite good prices.
Yeah, they're saying they're much like Sky, in terms of movies, they've got far more up-to-date catalogue than Love Film and Netflix. 10 times the amount of blockbusters. That's sort of similar to Sky Movies, I think. How much is it though?
Well, it was like £20 for the seat hold of
for a seat. That's a bit
three.
Cheaper. That's a bit cheaper than iTunes.
The only thing is, it's a bit limited in terms of only some devices allow you to watch it in high def.
Right. That's always been the case. I mean, not with Netflix so much, but with Love Film, there was quite a long time before.
I mean, it's not as ubiquitous as the other two are at the moment. But certainly, I thought as a platformer, it was quite impressive in where it was.
Until about 9 months ago that Tesco's owned it. They bought it 2 years ago, but it's, they've certainly got a lot of marketing power, so it would be interesting to see how another streaming service gets on. And they are, and like you say, it's quite, it's on more and more smart TV platforms. It's probably on about 60%, I would guess.
Talking about streaming, we're going to come back to that in a sec. So that's our tech news for this week, and we'll be back in a few seconds with movie news. This is great. I'm going to have this edited by about 9 o'clock tonight. That's pretty cool.
I'm going to cook a spaghetti.
It's not over yet, Phil.
I'm going to make a bolognese.
I'm making a bolognese as well.
Is it Monday bolognese now? Unofficially.
Actually, I haven't made one in ages. So I just thought it was a proper deal on decent plum tomatoes at my greengrocer.
It's the bolognese special.
Yeah. I'd just end up just whazz a load of tomatoes into a blender and just get yourself some proper pulpy goodness.
Okay, cool. So let's move on to movie news. And we'll come back to bolognese news if it's that important a little bit later.
Do an update next week.
Yeah. So anyway, we're talking about Netflix. House of Cards, it's won 3 Emmys last night at the time of recording this on Monday. And there were some other big winners, Steve.
Yes. House of Cards won 3 Emmys, and Breaking Bad won Best Drama Series, which wasn't a massive surprise. It's been doing very well at the Emmys for a number of years now. It's in its last season. And interestingly, it's being premiered on Netflix as well in the UK. So basically after it's shown on the US on Sunday evening, I think it is US time, the next day, Monday, UK time, Netflix show it. So that's a massive coup for Netflix in that sense, because Breaking Bad has been a huge series for the last 5 years, although it never got the coverage it really deserved in the UK for some reason. House of Cards winning is good news because you know, this was a big series for Netflix. You know, David Fincher was involved, and they put a lot of money into it. And I think, you know, it's just paid off handsomely in terms of both increased subscribers and in terms of critical appraisal. So that's good news. And then Steven Soderbergh, possibly his last film ever, he's announced his retirement as a director. It was Behind the Candelabra, which is about the life of Liberace, particularly his relationship with his lover, Scott Thurston. I mean, obviously, even though it seems really obvious to us now that he was gay, it was a well-kept secret at the time, despite the fact that his entire stage show was how massively camp he was. It's the funniest joke in Austin Powers. Who'd have thought Liberace was gay? He actually successfully sued a paper in the UK for claiming he was gay. And then he said afterwards, I cried. I cried all the way to the bank. It's actually excellent. I saw it actually last week. And Michael Douglas gives one of the great performances of his career as Liberace. He's absolutely superb in it. The only problem I had really was that Matt Damon was way, way too old to play the part of Scott Thurston, who was, I think, only 16 when he actually met Liberace in real life. It was a good movie. Really, really funny in places. And if it is Soderbergh's last film, well, that's a shame, because I actually quite like him as a director. In fact, I think he's had quite a good run recently, because I really enjoyed Haywire. He did Side Effects, which actually was a really good thriller that completely took me by surprise. I wasn't expecting it to be as good as it was. In fact, it was completely different from what I was expecting it to be about. And now the Liberace movie. So it's a good night all around for Netflix and for HBO, which is not uncommon. HBO has been pretty much dominating the Emmys for a long time now with the quality of its production. But it looks like it's interesting that they've had competition from Netflix.
Yeah, quite interesting that you mentioned those two in the same sentence there, Steve. I guess there's some comparisons between the two because of the cable companies. HBO is obviously a cable company, and prior to the release of The Sopranos in late 90s, 1999, I believe, cable companies were just all about reruns and low-budget movies, and then they introduced The Sopranos to the world, which was groundbreaking drama. And whilst you can't call House of Cards groundbreaking exactly, it's obviously streaming services are kind of known for the same thing, running old shows and all the rest of it. Kind of an interesting parallel between the two, and more original drama coming from the likes of Netflix. I think they promised five new shows in the next 12 months, and then doubling that up from there on in. And as you say, it drives subscriptions, and subscriptions drives new content.
Yeah, and what's impressed me is the quality of the shows. I mean, in the same way that HBO very much leave the creators to their own devices and give them an enormous amount of freedom in terms of what they can do, so is Netflix. And I've watched House of Cards and Orange is the New Black and Arrested Development, all of which were made by Netflix, and they've all been superb.
Yeah,
I haven't really got into Hemlock Grove yet, but I will get
into it. No, I've tried Hemlock Grove and I just couldn't get on with this. It's not my sort of thing. But yeah, it's mostly very high quality. I watched the original one, which was Lilyhammer, which was kind of a weird cross between The Sopranos and weird Nordic humour. But it was actually quite entertaining.
I couldn't get excited about Orange is the New Black, but the one that obviously doesn't get as much of a mention, and I don't think it's been as unequivocal a success, but was very interesting, was their third season of The Killing, the US version. Because obviously second season of that had been, because they made the very stupid mistake of not ending the first murder at the end of the first season. They dragged it out for a second season. It disappointed a lot of audiences and it fell by the wayside. So this time round, they actually did it, they wrapped it all up in one season. I thought it was exceptionally good, but it appears to be the one that me and my wife enjoyed and nobody else did, because I don't think that's going any further.
I wasn't even aware of it, Ed, to be honest.
That
was Netflix produced?
Yes, very much so.
Can you watch?
They never mentioned that one in the PR.
You can watch the first two seasons as well.
Can you watch the third season having not seen the first two seasons? Was there a lot of crossover?
No, not really. Don't get me wrong. You have a better understanding of the characters if you've seen the first two seasons. But it's chronological, but it's a completely separate case that they're dealing with, and. I thought it was genuinely good. I'm going to do the man a great disservice by being unable to remember his name, so I'm going to try and find it now. But the chap who is on death row in this season is absolutely it's just one of the best performances I've seen in any sort of television or cinema format in this year. It was absolutely fantastic. But I can't remember the bloke's name. which is embarrassing. But I'm trying to drag that up at the moment now. But it was seriously good. Although that said, having said that, I'm just looking at IMDb at the moment, and it's now got a fourth number next to it. So it is possible that actually I'm doing them a grave disservice, and they are going to keep going with it. But no, if you haven't watched it, Peter Sarsgaard is the man I was thinking there. He turns in an absolutely astonishing performance. If it's one that you haven't watched, then obviously treat yourselves. It's bloody marvellous.
We're going to need something new soon, because Breaking Bad is obviously about to finish, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. No finer time than to have a look at that. And obviously, after all of the distinctiveness of the sort of New Mexico scenery, you can get damp in Seattle instead.
I think I'll go from season one on that.
It's a great positive for, say, shows that have kind of fallen through the cracks of this traditional network system, isn't it? I mean, it seems any show that gets below a certain ratings after a season seems to get canned these days, particularly with things like sci-fi and the like. If it's not a storm to start with, if there's not a big kind of snowball momentum behind it, then it just tends to, you know, get cut, whether it's reached anything like a conclusion or not.
No, completely. Yeah.
The networks in the US are absolutely ruthless when it comes to that sort of thing.
I mean, when you look back at stuff like, Seinfeld in the early days, I mean, they could have canned that after like one or two seasons. They were saying that, you know, the ratings weren't that great, but they saw something, you know, they basically, I think they'd cancelled another show at the time. I forget what it was. And they were looking for something just to basically tide them over. So they kind of gave it another series. And from there, it kind of took off. And you realize that most of the kind of great series, it's kind of about season 3 or 4 that tends to get towards the high point. You know, it's very rarely hits the ground absolutely running. Something like a Sopranos is very much the exception.
Well, famously, Family Guy was cancelled by Fox.
Yes,
originally, and then brought back.
Everything was cancelled by Fox, though.
Yeah, well, there's a brilliant episode of Family Guy where they list a whole load of shows.
When they came back, the things that have been cancelled in our absence.
By the same token, I'm going to stick my neck out here. I think, it's now sufficiently successful that it's all, to my mind, it already has episodes which are more missed than hit. And this is where American networks get very, very strange. Having been comparatively and inexplicably ruthless at times, they'll then equally keep cash cows, you know, alive and functioning long after they should cease to be.
That's where, though, quality doesn't really matter, though. It's all about viewing numbers. I mean, in the early days, you can have a great series, but if it's getting no viewers, it gets canned. But something that continues to get viewers, you know, Lost carried on, what was that, about 4 seasons too long, probably, but it continued to get viewers.
So I mean, probably five seasons too long.
Yeah, it dwindled off so much, but yet still at the end, it was probably getting more than a new series would have, so they just continued with it.
That's something interesting about streaming services. They're not obliged to disclose their numbers. So if they're doing something pioneering, you know, something more adventurous, it didn't have to be recognised as a flop because only they know how many are seeing it. Now, whether they continue with the investment, but you think they might be more likely to if it's not publicly perceived as a disaster.
Yeah,
I'd like to know what the viewing figures are for something like Breaking Bad in the UK.
Yeah.
That's the thing, though. People these days, I mean, a bit like with, you know, talking about Grand Theft Auto and day one sales, people like to get involved with the hype now. People like to be there day one. People like to be able to kind of connect over social media and the like and to be able to say, yes, I watched that last night. Whereas, you know, if you have something that where the viewing figures are published straight away, everyone knows what it was. And people, if they miss the first episode, then they'll jump aboard with the second. But with something like Netflix, when they don't have to actually publish that, it allows this kind of a little bit of breathing space for things to kind of grow organically.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so to wrap up on this week's podcast, Steve, what's at cinema?
I went to go and see RIPD, which, if that isn't obvious enough for you, stands for Rest in Peace Department. If you've ever seen the film Men in Black, then you've already seen this film. It is a shameless ripoff of Men in Black. And I'm amazed that Universal haven't been sued by Sony, frankly. In the film, you have a police officer, played by Ryan Reynolds, who gets killed in a drug bust at the beginning, goes to heaven, or the afterlife, and gets informed that he can sort of bypass being judged for any sins on Earth if he joins the RIPD for 100 years. which he decides to do, and then gets partnered up with Jeff Bridges, who's basically an old lawman from the Wild West. And, you know, they go off together and introduces Ryan Reynolds' character to a whole sort of world that exists within our own world, where you have all these dead souls who are still on Earth trying to hide out from the RIPD. So exactly the same as Men in Black, where you've got, you know, a cop played by Will Smith getting inducted into the Men in Black organization, being partnered with a cranky old guy in the shape of Tommy Lee Jones, who then shows him, you know, all these aliens that are hiding amongst us. It's exactly the same premise, just done with dead people rather than aliens. And, you know, in that sense, it does make it somewhat boring, because you kind of think, well, I've already been here before. There are a few laughs in it, but, you know, it's just so unoriginal. And you kind of wonder who it's being made for, because it's not broad enough or funny enough for a mass audience. And it's not really quirky enough or horrible enough for sort of the more sort of horror end of the audience. And in fact, that's been proved by the fact that in the US it bombed. You know, it cost like 130 million, it made 35 million in the US. So it's already tanked there. And also, even though Jeff Bridges, you know, can play an aging Western lawman in his sleep, did he have like a stroke about 10 years ago? Because I cannot understand a word he says. He just slurs his way through the film, mumbling. And it was the same in True Grit, the same in anything I've seen him in recently. It just seems like he can't understand the word the guy says. But anyway, Mary Louise Parker's in it, playing the sort of the head of the Boston Department of the RIPD. She's probably the best thing in it, actually. She's kind of quite funny and quirky. But otherwise, it's just hopelessly derivative and a ripoff of Men in Black. So,
I was just thinking out loud here. Ryan Reynolds, he's clearly quite a personable human being and not afraid, you know, to do a bit of self-mockery. He's, you know, he turned up on various talk shows, Top Gear, etc. He seems quite a nice bloke. But I'm racking my brain to think of a single film he's been in that I've actually derived any satisfaction from.
He's very, very good in Buried. If you've seen Buried, that's a really good movie. The whole film takes place with him buried inside a coffin. It's superb. But he should really fire his agent, because you're right, he's a likable guy, competent actor, good looking. He's done some stinkers. And he really needs to get a new agent and do some good stuff again. He has done good movies, but, you know, he was in X-Men Origins, Wolverine playing Deadpool, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a great film.
As an example of a decent film.
No, I was saying of his dodgy films. He played Green Lantern, and that bombed as well. You know, he has picked a few stinkers in his time. The Proposal with Sandra Bullock was a shocker. Yeah, and yet, you know, he seems like the kind of guy that, you know, he does like voiceover stuff for Family Guy and that kind of stuff. He appeared in Ted. You know, he seems like he's happy to laugh at himself, and he's a reasonably charming guy. He just needs to get a new agent, I think.
Maybe it's because he's Canadian and he's too nice and he can't fire him.
Yeah, that's true. He is Canadian, yeah. Yeah, anyway, RIPD. It's available in 2D and 3D. I unfortunately had to It's available in 2D and 3D. Unfortunately, I had to sit through the 3D version because I forgot what time the 2D version was on. And it's a conversion, and you can tell it. You know, there are scenes where there's not enough depth, where there would be if it was shot with native 3D cameras, and other scenes where it's just too exaggerated and just gives away the fact that it's not real 3D. And it's kind of, I really hate conversions. But you've got a choice. You can go and see either. But I would give it a miss if I was you.
Did you make it to the end?
I kind of I did make it to the end. It's only 96 minutes long, and I kept looking at my watch thinking this is going on a bit, and so that's not a good sign either. it was like watching a bad remake of a film that you quite enjoyed, which is effectively what it is
in crappy 3D.
Yeah,
well, you see this shit, so we don't have to, Steve. That's the whole point.
Yeah, that's the whole point of it.
Right, so just to wrap up on the podcast this week, the passing of Ray Dolby last week got us thinking. Well, actually, it got us chatting earlier in the week, or even over the weekend, Steve, about our first home cinema setups, and going back over, you know, how we originally got into the hobby and what we had originally set up. Now, Ed, you're very much two channel, so let's go to you first.
So what, you want my first two-channel or my first multi-channel setup? Because there are two of them. And
Interestingly,
they've always been separate for me, which is sort of meant that they've always run concurrently.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're a young guy.
Less.
You're younger than us, anyway.
relatively young guy.
Tosser.
who's the tosser? Ed or me? Answer this very carefully.
I'm younger and have.
No, it was aimed at Ed. I actually didn't hear what you said.
So Ed, how did you get into your hobby then? What was it that drew you in?
I've grew up in a house where there was always an audio system comprised of separate audio components. That was how music was done, as far as I was concerned. And then from there, the first system that I can claim ownership of as my own was assembled after my first summer of doing holiday jobs. I worked at an industrial laundry for 8 weeks, and that allowed me to assemble, let's think about this, it was a Cambridge Audio A3i, Marantz CD48 and Tannoy Mercury M3 floor standing loudspeakers. And the thing is that against all odds, I actually managed to get all three bits, not the bits I'd originally purchased, but I put all three bits together again about 4 years ago just to satisfy my curiosity. And actually, it sounded pretty good, mainly because the Tannoys didn't really matter what you put into them. They always sounded pretty sweet. And then I'm afraid it's been one sickening and ruinously expensive path from there. I've had 15 stereo amplifiers, and in terms of source equipment, it's been equally painful as well. And then just to make life more complicated, multi-channel has always been separate to that. So whilst I was working at Richer Sounds, I took advantage of some scrupulous staff purchase deals. I've got myself a Yamaha DSP-AX620, which I think when I speak to people, loads and loads of people my sort of age started with that particular amplifier because they were being churned out by both Richer and Sevenoaks for about £4 over cost. And because I'm an idiot, I attached not one but two pairs of Rogers DB101 stand mounts. They were little sort of Dalek shaped things, but they were for really, really 4 ohms with no apologies. And it's a testament to Yamaha that amplifier didn't melt, because I then tried it with a Marantz AV receiver without thinking, and I melted it in about 6 minutes. So that Yamaha was seriously tough. And do you want to know a really strange thing? That Yamaha amp I purchased, my first home cinema receiver, now provides the background music for a Rotary Club in a suburb of Sydney, Australia. And I'm not making that up.
Mr. Botwright, how did you get into the hobby, and what kind of systems have you had?
Being perhaps just a touch younger, for me, it was very much late into kind of home cinema and that kind of thing. Started off with, well, TV speakers aren't much cop, and then looked at sound bars, and I think I had one, maybe two of those, and then I just found that, well, it might just be easier just to get a couple of speakers at the front, and then that slowly kind of evolved. And then, you know, before you know it, you're kind of drilling into walls and the like, and then deciding, now's a good time to redecorate and perhaps think about different displays. But I think generally I've stayed towards very much, by your standards, the budget end of the market, generally tying things to my games consoles, which don't tend to kind of really push beyond just standard Dolby Digital 5.1. So I've never really found much use for 7.1 or anything like that. I tried it for a while, but it just never really stuck with me beyond a couple of Hong Kong discs that did tend to use it quite well with lossless sound formats. And there I've just kind of tended to revert back to gaming, and sadly, I've got to say, through TV speakers here.
What with the soundbar revolution, you could at least presumably.
I was thinking about jumping back into that now, because it's a case of I popped a projector into another room, and I kind of put speakers in there, and then it got to the case where it was just a thing of. It almost seems like an effort when you've got just one screen that you tend to have everything hooked up to. You know, it came to the point where I was running out of plugs and putting in too many things with surge protectors and the like, that, you know, the things like projectors, they take a while to warm up and the like. So it just became a lot easier just to kind of stick with a pretty low-end Panasonic plasma. It just tends to do the job very well for gaming needs. And because so much of the time with games you are fiddling about with display settings, you can't just leave something, you know, as you would if when you've got a Blu-ray player hooked up. You do tend to, you know, virtually every game asks you to, you know, meddle about with, you know, calibration settings and, you know, gamma levels. And,
gamma and brightness levels. Yeah, you always have to mess with those. All over the shop.
Yeah, GTA 5. I mean, just it's got the brightness settings there, and it says, you know, make sure the logo is visible. And you say, well, what do you want? Just visible, very visible. What do you, you know? So again, you go back into the settings and you kind of monkey around with them. So nothing ever really stays set, which, you know, once you've got a kind of projector set up or anything like that, once you've got things nicely tuned, you don't really want to mess with that. So I think it's perhaps easier, though. I think that's one of the reasons why people tend to stick with lower setups if you're just doing it for gaming needs, because a lot of kind of game mixes are pretty rough around the edges. You know, they go for bombast first and a lot of kind of lens flare and that kind of thing, and it can be a bit blinding and a bit daunting.
Okay, let's move on. These are subjects we can obviously come back to in future weeks. Hodge, how do you get started?
Similar to Ed, in terms of I used to go visit an uncle, auntie and uncle, who was really into his hi-fi, so he had lots of hi-fi separates around. So that always sort of, I always used to play with it when he was out, basically. And then more moving to the television side when I was about 9, 10, obviously, and transpired TV, got my first portable. Then I just got into a hobby of buying and selling TVs from the local Viking until they got bigger and bigger. So I think at age 12, I had an enormous 28-inch CRT at the end of my bed. And then there was something of a hiatus then through my 20s. I got back into it when my grandma died. And she left me so funny.
Wondering what the hell you were up to in your 20s.
Yeah, a bit of boom, 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 yes. Boom, ch, boom.
So, yeah, there was no need for a TV at that point.
Sleep.
Yes, passing of a dear grandmother and a drunken afternoon in the pub, going past the Sony Center. I think I'll have a bit of that. So I went in and just bought myself a big system, 32-inch top-of-the-line CRT, and various a DAV something or other, I can't think, surround sound system, and various bits and pieces. And that was it. That was the renaissance of my love of AV. And that's until where I am now is surrounded by setup. I have a setup in three different rooms, just from kit, from review kit mainly. I normally have like three setups. So I'm sat in the bedroom at the moment with a 42-inch plasma. Next door's a 40-inch LED as a 58.
You're supposed to send these back, you know.
No, I do. It's a 50-inch plasma under the stairs and a 58-inch LED, and then there's a couple of sound bars knocking around. Confessions of a reviewer time. I just, you know,
you just haven't got around to
it.
Yeah,
okay. And a load of remote controls.
Confessions of a reviewer. My wife has now bought three of those mug tree things from one of the lifestyle stores, and we use them solely to store pairs of headphones. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Of course, joking aside, everything does go back, even though Mark's got all that equipment in his house. Myself, I'll keep it nice and short. I got into music at high school, well, before that, but really got into it at high school, DJing, so I had a love for music. Also had a love for film, and the two kind of met early 90s, bought a laser disc player, AV amp, and it grew from there, basically. Just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger until I got a dedicated room, projection screen projector, but only 5.1. See no need for 7.1 in my room, and I don't have the room for it. So moved from laser disc, didn't want to go to DVD, and this is what me and Steve were talking about the other day, leading up to this conversation. I was very anti-DVD, and I think it was because I'd spent an absolute bloody fortune on Laserdisc. When you consider each film was about £30 just for a single film, and then when you got into the deluxe box set, is hundreds of pounds. I mean, the Star Wars box set cost me hundreds of pounds. I saved up for months for that. Yeah. So yeah, going to DVD, I was a bit reluctant, and then when I saw it, it was like, oh yeah, I'm going to have to upgrade for that. And funnily enough, my love's moved from sound. I was really, really sound-orientated and not that bothered about picture. back in the days of CRT, but I've kind of gone the other way now. Well, completely gone the other way now, where picture is just as important as sound to me now. Whereas I wasn't really that bothered when I first got into the hobby, and maybe like other people, that was kind of how it develops. You know, you realise just how much more you can get out of the display rather than the factory settings, and then you get interested in that, interested in calibration, and move on from there. So for the last 20 odd years, it's just developed, and my bank balance is never been big, because it's always been spent on the latest and greatest. So, all right, time to go to Hong Kong.
No. I wasn't going to mention Hong Kong or Tokyo.
I'm more interested in your DJing.
Why?
Were you vinyl or CDJs?
Oh, was it roller disco?
No. It was definitely. It wasn't a roller disco.
The odd gig.
No, I'm just thinking of like the bloke in Phoenix Nights.
No, it wasn't Dave the Raver. Or
coming in your ears.
No, I was very much, well, I did a whole host of things. I would do weddings and all that kind of thing, but really I was more club, sort of late 80s, early 90s, through about 98, more club, a couple of Technics 1200s, mixer.
Right, so
I was
proper
happy.
DJing.
Oh yeah, proper DJing, yeah. I knew it was scratch and everything.
Yeah, but how did that affect your DJing? No, sorry. It's fine. It's interesting. The one thing, I don't know about you guys, that even before I sort of switched to reviewing, and even, you know, I'm complaining about this from a position where obviously I can normally extend to you know, buying items direct off certain manufacturers. I find the depreciation involved with most home cinema gear these days, the lifespan and how little it's worth after an appallingly short period of time, to be so depressing that essentially I replace these days almost on a I need to because it's exploded basis, rather than because I feel compelled to chase another aspect of performance.
As reviewers, what tends to happen is that I can't speak for the other guys, but your personal TV, if you're reviewing TVs, tends to get locked in a cupboard because constantly got TVs coming through and piling up, and you're constantly swapping them over. Same with projectors. If you own a projector, I mean, I got rid of my projector because I was reviewing so much that it just wasn't being used, and I thought, well, rather than lose money on it, I'll get rid of it now. And you know, my movie watching depended on what I had in for review. For a few weeks, I'd catch up with movies, and then that would go back, and I'd wait for something else. But that, as a reviewer, that's how it tends to happen, or certainly
in
my case.
Yeah, exactly. TV soundbar. I've always got a combination of something that I'm reviewing, so I'm using that. I don't really.
Also, I can't remember the last bit of AV kit that I actually went out and bought.
Yeah. I bought a television 8 weeks ago. I had to. My other one had expired. And
I trust you asked us for advice first,
Ed. I looked at the reviews.
What did you buy?
I bought GT 86.
GT86. What's a GT? GT60.
Yeah, sorry, that's it.
The GT86
is
a car.
Is a car, yes.
So, you won't get a very good picture on that car.
No, but probably a damn sight more exciting. No, just Panasonic cars.
Right, let's move on to Steve and wrap this up, because we really are fast running out of time, and people have got gigs and stuff and Bolognese to make. So on you go, Steve.
Yeah, well, mine started, I had a bit like Ed, we had a two-channel system when I was about 18. It was a NAD stereo amplifier and you know, a couple of Mission speakers. And then I rented, back in the days when you could do this, rented a VCR. My dad had a VCR, but I wanted one for my bedroom, so I had a TV up there. So I rented a VCR, and it was a Nikon stereo VCR, which was when they were just first getting introduced, so about 87, 88, and plugged it into, you know, the analog stereo outputs into the back of the NAD amp, and suddenly I had stereo sound from the VCR, and that was,
I think that was everybody's entry, certainly at our age, Steve. Mm. That was everybody's entry. It was like, oh, I can plug these into the back of the hi-fi.
Yeah, and suddenly it's like, hang on a minute, this sounds really good. You know, compared to sound, you know, coming through a TV speaker. And also a friend of mine at the same time as I was having this revelation, he had bought a Dolby surround processor, which I think was one of their very first domestic processors that they launched on the market. Unfortunately, he didn't have a hi-fi, a stereo VCR. He had a mono VCR and didn't realize that it wasn't going to work with it, because he tried it out. This is bollocks, and sent it back. And then he came around my house and I plugged in this stereo VCR and he suddenly realized the enormity of his mistake. And hello, Will, if you're listening to this, by the way, and he does listen to this, yes, it was him that screwed up. He's actually the guy I'm going to go and see Manic Street Preachers with in a minute. Yeah, and so then we got a ProLogic decoder, and I did a couple more speakers and thought, oh, okay, this is great. And then, of course, it just escalated from that. So you can go to Laserdisc and Dolby Digital and DTS, DVD, DVHS, HD DVD, Blu-ray, lossless audio, 7 channels, plus probably more. But it started with a rented Nikon stereo VCR.
Yeah, exactly where I started as well. Obviously, the audio side was bigger than that. And then when I suddenly realised I could do that, I was like, oh, this is great. And I always remember my first demo of 5.1 Dolby AC3 on Laserdisc. It was the Lion King disc on a Yamaha 3090 and a Pioneer 925 Laserdisc player. And I ended up buying the lot after the demo because I'd never had anything like it. It was like, oh man, I've got to have this. And then I had a Pioneer 50-inch rear projection TV, which ended up in a local pub once I got rid of it.
At least with Laserdisc, it's still, in its own way, it's kind of retro chic. I mean, I spent a fortune on mini disc. It was a complete and utter waste.
So did I.
I have absolutely nothing to show for a lot of money.
I love the editing capability. That's what I bought it for. I bought it for the editing capability when I was making mixtapes and stuff. And yeah, all these mistakes that we made, eh? All that money down the drain.
Hundreds of thousands of pounds, if I'm being honest.
Well, let's hear the forum member stories. How did you get started in the hobby? Was it like myself and Steve in the late 80s with Nikon stereo videos, or did you come to it a little bit later on? And have you changed from being more sound to picture, or more picture to sound? Because I always find talking to AV guys, it's one or the other. There's very few are both, and I find that strange in a way, that it's either really into the audio or really into the picture, but you know, not across both of them.
I'm definitely both. Big picture, big sound.
So Steve's by.
Steve swings both ways.
he'll be with you in 5 minutes, Will.
Just got that, so.
By the time he hears this, it'll be too late.
He doesn't know what you've got in store for him. He thought he was going to a concert.
Put this rock mask on.
Yeah, he doesn't like the rock. Don't worry. No, unless the rock's in a fate. Camp English bloke. Very well.
Can I leave this in, Steve?
Yes, yes, you can definitely leave it in.
Is that what he's going to say to you later on?
Is that his price? I promise a name check in the AVO Forums podcast.
Very easily pleased then. Mm. So, unfortunately, that wraps everything up for the AV Forums podcast, but do leave your story of how you got into the hobby, and we will have a special podcast coming up in a couple of weeks as well, telling you about all the changes coming to AV Forums. But for now, I need to thank Mark Buttright.
Thank you, Chuck Norris.
Mark Hodgkinson.
I love the smell of queef in the morning.
Ed Selly.
It's time to put your mouth where our balls are.
And Steve Wynn. That's what Steve's doing. Steve Withers.
You had me at blood and semen.
It's like the bullet points of Steve's evening.
Can I just say something before we finish this? I am heterosexual.
Yeah, but that won't make the edit.
Yeah, that was good callback to earlier on the show.
Right, don't forget you can follow us on Twitter at AV Forums, on Facebook, facebook.com/AV Forums, on YouTube, AV Forums TV, go and watch the latest videos, and of course, avforums.com, bookmark it for the latest news, reviews, videos, and podcasts. I'm Phil Hinton, thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you again next Wednesday.